Contrary to what you might have gathered from Alessandro earlier, I'm not against attitude functions per se. I want to say that they're not a fundamental feature of the structure of actions, but they are a real feature of the of attitudes. But they are a real feature of the structure of attitudes, nonetheless. So, what I want to say is that the model of evaluative attitudes that emerges from social psychology distinguishes two mutually irreducible dimensions of attitudes, I think. That's attitude content and attitude strength. Many psychologists argue for this third dimension, attitude function. And what I want to try to argue is that attitude function is reducible to patterns of attitude content and strength. But that's not to deny that attitudes have functions. Okay, and reductionism is a word that gets used in many ways, in many different disciplines, but I'm using it in the way it's used in philosophy, in metaphysics, in philosophy of mind. Reductionism is not eliminativism. It is not the view that the thing that's getting reduced isn't real. Right? It's the view that it is real, because the thing to which it's reduced is real, and it is the same thing as that. Okay. So, when I say that attitude functions are reducible to patterns of content and strength, I think that that's what attitude functions are, is patterns of content and strength. Okay, so the section is in, the talk is in seven sections, but I'm going to skip section six. For reasons of time. So the first section is this, on the cognitive affective personality system, which will be familiar to some of you, I'm sure. This is a model of personality and a model of behavioural cognition, most associated with Walter Michel, of this paper he wrote with Yuichi Shoda in 1995. There's a number of other papers of Michel and Shoda, and Michel with other colleagues too, and it strikes me that it's a very well evidenced model of behavioural cognition, and it offers a framework that could help to ground the integration and development of what currently looks like a very unruly zoo of constructs in social psychology. So I'm one of the people who wants to be part of that program. Now, the CAPS model, Cognitive Affective Personality System, models behavioural cognition as a connectionist system, right? And it actually says something relatively simple. The nodes in the connectionist system are described as cognitive affective units. In different papers over time, they've given different examples of what these cognitive affective units are, and this has actually led to some criticism of the theory. I think it doesn't really matter that much what we think that they are. What's crucial about the model is that these are connected to one another by associative connections of varying strengths. And what makes this a connectionist model is that energy flows through the system, diffusing across the associations in proportion to the strength of the different associations. And secondly, that each time energy flows across a particular association, that association increases slightly in strength. Those two things together, I think, are what makes it a connectionist model. And as I say, it doesn't matter that much what the cognitive affective units are. Or to put it better, perhaps, the point of the model is to offer a framework within which other areas of psychological research can develop models of what those cognitive affective units are. And that's why it looks like a useful integrative perspective. I think it provides, as I'll show you, a very efficient explanation of attitude content, attitude strength, and the relation between the two. But then I have a problem, because it's not obvious, immediately obvious, what to do with attitude function if you want to model attitudes this way in as part of the cognitive affective personality system. That's my interest, that's my concern with this question, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. Okay, section two, attitudes and their components. Attitudes are often defined, as indeed Alessandra defined them not very long ago in this very room, as cognitive states that relate an object to a valence. Alessandra's licorice is now my celery. I hate celery, and my disliking celery therefore relates celery to a negative valence. Here's a nicer example for my purposes. I think democracy is a good thing. Valuing democracy relates democracy to a positive valence. Okay. Now, I think that the cognitive structure of an attitude is best understood as being the set of cognitive and affective states that explain that overall valence. So my pro-democracy attitude is explained by a large set of my cognitive states, including, for example, that my belief that democracy is the best way to keep the peace, my desire that the peace be kept, my belief that democracy best coordinates the autonomy of the individuals ruled over, and so on, and so on. And it's because I have all those other beliefs and desires, those other cognitive states and affective states, that I have this overall attitude that's a pro-democracy attitude. That set of states is sometimes understood as the base of an attitude. I think this was the language Alessandra was using. And sometimes that language makes it sound as though that's the base of the attitude, and then the attitude is a different cognitive state, right? A different association between an object and a valence that's kind of caused by that state. I think that proliferates the structures unnecessarily. I think that comes at an explanatory cost, and so we shouldn't do it. Unfortunately, section 6 is where I'm going to explain that explanatory cost, so that's on the handout, but I'm not going to give it in this talk. I think instead we should think in terms of rough-grained and fine-grained descriptions of the same overall state. Or perhaps even better, we should think of these different descriptions of the state, so saying he's pro-democracy or saying that he thinks all these complicated things about democracy, are low-resolution and high-resolution pictures of the same cognitive setup, of the same stuff that's going on. That's the metaphor I think I prefer to low, fine-grained and rough-grained. I think in terms of high-res and low-res descriptions of the same cognitive structure. So you can look at the same cognitive structure by zooming in and seeing it in more detail. Okay, so if you start thinking that way, that the overall attitude is a low-res description and a high-res description is the set of beliefs and desires that make it up, or that are its base. What does that tell us about attitude content and attitude strength? Well, attitude content is the next thing I'm going to talk about. An attitude's content can be described in low-res, pro-democracy, or high-res, right? The states comprising the attitude. The high-res description can include states whose valence opposes the low-res valence overall. So, for example, my overall pro-democracy attitude might include the belief that actually current models of democracy give too much power to media moguls, which is a kind of negative attitude about contemporary democracy, but still it adds up to an overall pro-democracy attitude. It can also include mental states that distinguish varieties of the object. So I might think that some democracies have better voting systems than others, for example, but that can all be part of my overall, the content of my overall pro-democracy attitude. Now, to switch from that high-res, low-res imagery for a moment into the metaphysical language that I want to use about attitude functions, okay, what I'm saying is that the content pro-democracy is reducible to the set of cognitive and affective contents. And as I say, reduction is not elimination. I'm not denying that I have a pro-democracy attitude, or a pro-democracy attitude content. I'm also not denying the utility of talking about attitudes in that low-res way. In some contexts, it's better to talk in that low-res, rough-grained way. In other contexts, it's better to talk in a more fine-grained way. So I'm not denying the importance of that low-res description. All I'm saying is that my pro-democracy attitude is not a separate item caused by the set of cognitive affective states that explain it. It just is that that set. Okay, what does this tell us about attitude strength? As Alessandra mentioned, an attitude strength is not its degree of valence, right? Just because I really hate celery, that's not what makes it a strong attitude, right? Instead, what attitude strength is how firmly the attitude is part of the cognitive system. It's measured by I've got four measures of attitude strength here. How certain the subject is of it, how important it is to them, its centrality to their self-image, and whether it expresses a larger value of theirs. And if you measure strength by those measures, as I understand it, what you can do is predict the degree to which the attitude persists, how resistant it is to attempts to change it of various kinds, how much it influences cognition, and how much it influences behaviour. Now, people often talk in terms of strong and weak attitudes when they're describing attitude strength, but don't be misled by that. Sometimes that can sound like a binary distinction, like there's two kinds of attitudes, the strong ones and the weak ones. That's just an artifact of the way in which this, what's actually a scalar distinction, is operationalized. Really, attitudes are stronger or weaker. Right. Okay. So where does that leave us? Well, here's how attitudes fit into the cognitive affective personality system as I see it. Here's why I think CAPS helps to model attitudes. An attitude just is a set of cognitive and affective units connected by a complex network of associations, I want to say. An attitude's content, at whatever level of specification, is a function of the contents of the members of that network, the network that make up that attitude. And an attitude's strength can just be modelled as a function of the strengths of the connections between those members. And if you think of it that way, then modelling attitudes this way explains why the measures of strength predict the effects of strength. The stronger the overall set of associative connections that bind together the items that make up the attitude, the more persistent and resistant to change that attitude will be, because it's bound together by these strong associative connections. The stronger that set of connections, the more easily and readily the attitude is brought to bear on cognition. So the more certain the subject is of it, and the higher its influence on cognition and behaviour. And conversely, the more important an attitude is to a person, the more central it is to their self-image and bound up with larger values, the more we should expect those associative connections to have been deployed in deliberation and behaviour, and so strengthened. So CAPS helps to explain how attitude strength works and why the measures of attitude strength predict the effects of attitude strength. So that's what's so good about modelling attitudes in terms of CAPS. And now on the back of the handout, I've got section 6, which tells you some more good things about modelling attitudes in terms of CAPS. But I'm going to skip that and get to the problem that I face instead. So section 7, where then does function fit in? There seems no obvious place to slot in function for CAPS. Content and strength, the two dimensions of attitudes I've talked about, fit very well in the CAPS model, but in a way that shouldn't be a surprise. The CAPS model is a connectionist model, and connectionism is all about the strengths of associations between contents. Right? So it looks like the CAPS model of attitudes requires that we do one of two things. Either we eliminate attitude functions altogether and just say, forget about them, or we reduce them to patterns of content and strength. My preference is for reduction, the second thing, because this preserves the explanatory and predictive utility of attitude functions, whereas if you're going to eliminate them, you basically have to deny that or explain it away. So the question is this reduction plausible? Can I just say there you go, is my last one. Can I just say that attitude functions are patterns of content and strength? Well, one way to think about that is to run through some of the big attitude functions that people talk about the most. And this is what I'm going to do. So the object appraisal function of attitudes. There the idea is that the function is to maximise reward and minimise punishment, right? To facilitate the subject approaching what is beneficial and avoiding what is harmful. And, as people in this room say in their book, this is served best by attitudes that are strong enough to have high level of influence over cognition and behaviour, right? So it's got to be influential, highly influential over cognition and behaviour in order for it actually to affect whether or not you get the benefits and avoid the harms. But here's a further point. What counts as a benefit? What counts as a harm? What is reward? What is punishment? That has to be determined, it seems to me, by other attitudes of the same subject, right? And so for that reason, where am I? And those attitudes have to be strong enough themselves to not simply be revised in response to behaviour, but to drive behaviour. So the object appraisal function, it seems to me, can be reduced to the strength of the attitude combined with it having strong associations with other strong attitudes. And those determine whether it's beneficial or harmful, whether it's approached or avoided. So, one win for me, right? It's going to get tougher. The value expressive function. Now, the idea of the value expressive function is that an attitude with that function expresses an individual's self-concept and an individual's central values. Now, I think this fits very nicely with the idea of attitude strength. After all, attitude strength is measured by how important the attitude is to the subject, its centrality to their self-image, and whether it expresses a larger value of theirs, plus their certainty of it. So those three measures show us that a strong attitude should just fit the description of a value-expressive function, right? Because it's measured by essentially the same thing. But that's not the only kind of attitude, I think, that fits the value-expressive function. A weaker attitude could serve that function by associating its object with an existing strong attitude. So if I have a very strong attitude towards healthy foods, it's very firmly embedded in my cognitive system, it drives my cognition and behaviour and so on and so forth, and then I discover that blueberries are very healthy, now I've got a pro-blueberry attitude, right? It's quite a weak attitude because I've only just formed the association between that and healthiness, but nevertheless it's a value-expressive function. So it gets its value expressiveness from its association with a strong pro-healthy foods attitude. Okay, that's a second win for me. Value expressive functions and object appraisal functions look to be reducible. This is where it gets harder. The social adjustment function. The idea here is to help one associate oneself with or dissociate oneself from some specific social group or social individual. An example in one book, which might be Greg and Jeff's book, is liking Pepsi because you like Michael Jackson and he advertises Pepsi. But there are lots of ways in which these kind of social adjustment functions could work. I want to say, well, maybe this could just be understood this way. In a high-res description of the function, what's happening here is the set of cognitive and affective states that comprise the attitude, in this case the pro-Pepsi attitude, includes a belief about the target group's attitudes or the target individual's attitudes and a strong positive attitude towards that group. Right? So it's actually part of my attitude towards Pepsi, whether I realise it or not, that that I believe that Michael Jackson likes it and I like Michael Jackson. I think I can get away with that, so that's possibly a third win for me. Here's the big question that I wanted to raise, and it's Alessandra's favourite attitude function, right? The ego defensive function. This is where the function of the attitude is to protect my self-image from threats. So again, I think this is Greg and Jeff's book example. Somebody who is part of their self-image that they're an excellent sports person, and they're not very good at golf. So they hate golf, right? And they think golf is objectively a bad thing. There's something wrong with it. It's not a proper sport. Whatever. I don't know what to say about this. As you'll see as the last line on the handout. I don't know what to say about the ego defensive function, so I'm asking for your help. I would like it to be reducible to content and strength. Otherwise, I'm stuffed. Thank you very much.